From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Now, journalists in your community are reporting on the COVID-19 pandemic. They are doing their best to try and help you understand what's happening right outside your front door. But the local news outlets they're working for are struggling even more to keep those very same journalists on the payroll. So we want to talk about what that means for those local news outlets and the communities they serve. And to help us do that, we're going to start today with Bree. She joins us from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there, Bree.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're a local reporter through and through to the core?
I would say so, yes. I've been covering, health for the Plain Dealer in Cleveland for about 14 years, and for the past 5 years really focusing on public health.
Had been.
Yes, I had to correct myself there.
Meaning what?
Meaning I was laid off on April 3rd.
April 3rd. In the middle. So you're the health reporter for the Plain Dealer. Were the health reporter. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And in the middle of this pandemic, you lost your job?
Yes, among many others at our newspaper. And I was one of three health reporters, and none of those health reporters are working at the Plain Dealer anymore.
So what happened?
So I think this has been coming for a while. I mean, I'm sure that your listeners have seen this happen all over the country. Really, it's just for me, for the past 7 years, it's been nothing but pain and stress as we've seen the staff just shrink and shrink. So we were down to about 32, and close to, I think, 25 to 28 of us are now gone. So there are four union reporters left at the Plain Dealer in Cleveland.
Okay, so when did you first get wind recently that this was going to happen?
I think we heard in early March. I could be wrong about that, but we knew we'd known for a while that it was coming and the number of people that would be leaving. I guess we all had a little bit of time to prepare for it, but it's difficult at any time. It's particularly hard as a health reporter in my community to watch what's happening during the pandemic from the sidelines.
Yeah.
I've felt like it's like training for a marathon for years and then twisting your ankle mid-race and watching everybody just pour past you to the finish line. So it's tough. It's painful.
Yeah. I want to go back in time with you for a second, Bree, because you've been working at the Cleveland Plain Dealer for 14 years. But just to focus on this moment again, obviously, health reporting is vitally important for the people of Cleveland. There's also, in addition, all the local reporting that's done regarding what city and state officials are doing. And there are choices around managing the COVID-19 pandemic, about the availability of testing, about schools, about unemployment. I mean, how much of that is the Plain Dealer still able to do?
Well, I think there are still 60 plus journalists in our city that are working hard on this. And, I think every journalist is working very hard right now. It's just that there are, 20 something fewer journalists in our city now. And, anytime you lose reporters, you're losing some of that ability to go out there and ask the questions and hold power to account and all of those things that we do for the community. It's not just about that, we want to know what's going on in our communities. It's really that we need to know in order to be engaged and empowered citizens.
So when you started at the Plain Dealer 14 years ago, how many reporters did the newspaper have?
More than 300.
300?
Yes.
More than 300?
Yes.
And now you said there are 60 reporters remaining?
60, yes, and four at the Plain Dealer.
Oh, okay. So four at the Plain Dealer, but the other 60, so at Cleveland.com?
Yes, they work for the digital side of the operation.
I see. Okay. So regardless, that's a huge drop.
It is.
This has been happening for some time.
Right. And it's part of a nationwide erosion of local journalism and fewer experienced reporters out there doing what we do. It's, when there's less local journalism, you have less competitive elections. Public officials tend to crawl back under their rocks and that nobody's turning over anymore. And then we have to rely on their word as to what they're up to.
Uh-huh. I got to ask, and I hope this doesn't cause too much of a pang in your heart right now, Bree, but if you were if you were doing health reporting for the Plain Dealer right now, what kind of stories would you be going after?
Well, I mean, I think that's, I would continue to do what we had been doing right up until the end. I mean, everybody just, we were all just killing ourselves to get information out there, writing about testing, writing about the hold up with getting results back to people, writing about the disproportionate effect of the epidemic on the communities of color and really the folks who have less in our community, how they're faring. That's a lot of the work that we were doing. And it's what I wish I could still be out there doing right now.
Mm. And of course, the truth is that because you can't be out there doing it right now, that maybe that work is being done, but not as robustly or as deeply when you simply just don't have as many people doing it. So that's what your readers, your community members are missing out on.
Yes, absolutely. It just, you know, sheer numbers. You need folks out there asking these questions. And as you have fewer and fewer, you're going to get fewer answers, and you're going to have, all the sort of bad stuff that happens when people aren't looking is going to keep happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, as your fellow reporter, Bree, I will tell folks that when you were let go, you were told that you had to sign an agreement saying that you would not disparage the company that owns the Cleveland Plain Dealer or the product. So a non-disparagement agreement that you were forced to sign. Just wanted people to know that. And I guess my last thought from you is, when you look into the future, given what you and the company that you've worked for 14 years have been through, what do you see as the future for local news?
Well, I think the model has to change in some way, because we've just been, putting Band-Aids on these gaping wounds for years now. So it can't survive the way that it is, and it's clearly not surviving the way that it is. And so I hope that there is some way, whether it's a nonprofit, whether we get some sort of stable funding source to keep doing this, because I think it's important to people, and they may not realize how important it is until they don't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bree Zeltner is or was the health reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. She worked for the Plain Dealer for 14 years, and she was recently laid off. She joined us today from Cleveland via Skype. Bree, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And I really am keeping my fingers crossed that someone out there is going to realize that there's a great reporter that they could scoop up right now.
Thanks so much. And thanks for talking.
Yeah. Well, we are talking about how the COVID-19 pandemic is hitting local news, really cratering it out, just as people are relying on local news more than ever. We've heard from In preparing for this show, we did hear from quite a few members of local media outlets across the country. For example, here is Sarah. She's an editor at Outlier Media in Detroit. Her outlet is texting people important news and information because many folks in Detroit do not have internet or reliable broadband. And so she says Detroit journalists are doing valuable work, but the reality for local news is still grim.
Some of the best reporters in Detroit are on furlough this week. And that is a tough reality, that even when people are doing some of the most vital work of their careers, they're being sidelined because the business models that news relies on, don't support this type of work.
Well, you know what? The best person to talk about this is my colleague, David Folkenflik. He is, of course, co-host of On Point and NPR's media correspondent, and he has been following the downward trajectory of local news for many, many years. So, David, how are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing well, and thanks for being with me here today, because this is something that's been going on for so long. How profound is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on an already weakened local news ecosystem?
I mean, just think about the fact that you and I talked about this in February, about the peril to local news and the concerns about the news business. And that was before it was clear that there was going to be this incredible national hit and this incredible hit to the economy of the news business itself. And the local news business is particularly brutalized because it didn't figure out a way to get money off charging people a paywall. Want to take a look at Cleveland for a moment. You know, that was owned by a company, Advance, which is owned by the Newhouses, Condé Nast, the New Yorker, Wired, publications like that, part of the same big corporation. They'd been trying for a lot of years to segue essentially their staff into the digital side, as Bree alluded, and to then allow their news product to be a vessel through which that content would pour. And so really what you're seeing was them push way down the number of folks on the print side and bump up to some extent the side on the digital, but it's still a diminished product. Well, now they don't have paywall subscribers. Chris Quinn, who's a longtime Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter and editor who became a Cleveland.com executive, has basically put out a request for voluntary subscriptions, which sounds a lot to me like public radio stations, mm-hmm. and saying, could you give money to us? We don't charge you for it. We intend to be here regardless, but my goodness, we need the money. And they've started to make cost cuts even beyond the ones of reporters like Bree, whose reduction in staff were caused by long-planned restructuring, not by this additional crisis that's levied on top of the financial problems of the news business.
And the story that we're seeing unfold and at the Plain Dealer, it becoming now a literal husk of what it was, we're seeing that in cities across the country.
You know, look, in some ways what they're doing is sidestepping the union structure. And as a longtime union member, I think there are reasons why that actually benefits readers and listeners and viewers as well as the newsrooms themselves. But they're sidestepping it. And in many ways, it's analogous to what you're seeing in other parts of the country. I will say the owners there, it's a privately held company. They could make the case that in a number of their markets, they sustained higher levels of staffing in their newsrooms than they probably could afford, given their revenues. But they're sure turning that around and making some tough cuts across the board.
Well, David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent and, of course, On Point co-host. And we're talking this hour about the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic is having on local news across the country just when it is needed the most. There is a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My On Point co-host, David Folkenflik, is here with me this hour to help us understand the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic is having on local news across the country and what is lost, what impact it has on democracy when local news disappears. And David, we got some voicemails from listeners and readers responding to this question. This is Reka from Arlington, Massachusetts, and she called us to talk about the lack of local news in her community. She says there's a small local newspaper, but it doesn't reflect conversations happening in the community.
So often local news in Arlington, Massachusetts comes to us directly from the town and some residents' email lists and Facebook groups. And I can tell you that is not a great way to share information or stay informed. It can be fun to let off steam. It can be fun and interesting at times, but it is not a good replacement for the journalism we need. I've lived here for 10 years, and it feels like the town is changing so much. It just feels like we're bursting at the seams, our schools, our traffic, our real estate market. I love this place, but I really feel like I need to know more about it.
That's Reka from Arlington, Massachusetts. Now, David, I think Reka's really getting to something there, that there was this sort of utopian thought for some time that, okay, well, if the number of local journalists goes down, we still have all these other means of information spreading, social media, et cetera. But, you know, there's not a perfect overlap there by any means.
Oh, you're so right. And I remember that time. It's like, well, you know, the public is the audience will replace the professionals and it's all fine. Actually, you kind of need one to stimulate the other. Like the one inspires, one provides the grist for people to argue puff. You need actual reporting and you need people to provide not simply an amplification of what public officials and major institutions say, or just highlighting, rants of the day from Facebook, although that can be part of it. But you need some mediation of it. You need some reporting. You need some scrutiny. You need some testing of assertions to see if they're fact. You need this. Arlington's, I'm not familiar with it, but it's not so far outside Boston. And these, suburbs, these other communities need their own coverage. The Boston Globe at one time really did cover the region around it, up into New Hampshire, probably southern Maine, down into Rhode Island. I think it is much closer to home in terms of where it can send people to do reporting on a daily or weekly basis simply by virtue of its own finances. So, yeah, you're seeing the paucity of coverage in a lot of towns and communities around the country. And I think our listener is exactly right that it's not hearing the conversation on Facebook, which itself is distortive of what conversation might be like over, mm-hmm. A hedge or a fence at home or a coffee downtown is itself not a replacement for, synthesis, an analysis, a breaking apart of what's being claimed in public.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more, David. And to the point, I'm sitting here in Boston. So to my colleagues at the Boston Globe, they are working hard as ever. But I don't think anyone would say that the Globe is the same paper that it was 20 or 30 years ago, just by virtue of size alone. And Bree was talking about how many reporters were lost at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The Boston Globe has lost quite a few reporters as well. And, the thing that concerns me the most, and I think concerns citizens or residents in any community that's lost the heart of its local news reporting, is that all of a sudden you get this sort of almost democracy black hole or an accountability black hole, because you kind of need the people whose job is to go to City Hall every single day and nag those politicians, or the State House every single day. And once that is gone, I mean, David, you know this as well as anybody, there's nothing to replace that.
Yeah, and let's be fair. John Henry and Linda Henry, who own control of the Boston Globe, have tried hard to sustain what they feel they can. And there has been a lot of good coverage from the journalists there. Our listeners have heard me whinge about the fates of the Baltimore Sun, where I worked for more mm-hmm. than a decade. And they are down. At our high, we had over 400 journalists in the newsroom. Now it's down to, I'm told, roughly 110 or so. But, the reporters there, despite the financial onus put on them by their ownership, we can talk about that in a minute or two, but nonetheless, in much diminished form, they essentially forced out a mayor showing this incredibly complicated web of corruption from a mayor who wrote a children's book and then forced the boards of all these institutions with which she had ties and influence as mayor to buy tens of thousands of copies of this book. She made hundreds of thousands of dollars off places like, I believe, the University of Maryland Medical System. Forgive me if I'm getting that slight detail wrong, but all these places around town that felt they were kind of required, had this money extorted from them, and they did it. And they took down the mayor. This wasn't because of enlightened corporate ownership or great funds put out there. This is because reporters are somehow still trying to do the job. But you know what? If there are fewer people showing up at City Hall, a lot people get away with a lot more. And also, let's think of how many people live in suburban and more rural counties outside of a huge city with a major city hall. I talked to a guy a year and a half back for the Denver Post, which itself has been gutted brutally by its corporate ownership at Alden Global Capital, an investment fund based in New York City. But these guys, the Denver Post told me he's covering the six counties that ring Denver City. So that is an extraordinary wow. amount of real estate to cover in your car. The idea that he can hold six counties accountable, much less deal with all the businesses that have influence on those counties, the utilities councils and other issues that come up. It's unfathomable that he could possibly do that. Mm-hmm. It's having the protection of a handkerchief in a hurricane. Yeah. And he's doing his best.
Yeah. Now, I just want to make a note that I'm sitting here at our home station of WBUR, and our colleagues here are working as hard as ever. And I hear from listeners all the time that because of the sort of slow diminishment of other sources of local news, public radio becomes ever more important. So I want to come back to that in a second here. But David, just to underscore something, in terms of the really precipitous drop-off in terms of local news reporting and reporters, just to set some facts on the table here, most of that has been in newspapers, right? I'm seeing over the last 15 years, some 1,800 newspapers have closed across the United States.
It's really rough. Newspapers, I think, have been the leading edge of this. As you and I talked about some weeks ago, the erosion of national advertising, the consolidation of major advertisers in things like department stores and cell phone operators, the ways in which Amazon and other online folks have basically said, you know, not only are we going to provide you services online, we're going to, you know, retain the advertising for ourselves. Google and Facebook owning so much in the way of ads. It's just stripped that away. Now, let me just say, what we've seen in the pandemic is something more severe, because what print advertising was left was still disproportionately important to newspapers, which, as you point out, have been traditionally the horsepower that drives the news ecocycle in cities and communities around the country. And so when you take away those print advertisers, which have been essentially flattened by the pandemic because of the, you know, obviously the shutting down of almost all businesses, you're seeing newspapers essentially saying, you know, we could lose 80% of our advertising revenue. And that is really, really rough. Around the country, you are seeing, you know, major – we talked a little bit. You started to see alternative newspapers really getting hit hard. They are free. Typically, they are very reliant on advertising for events, you know, bands, concerts, things like that, festivals, things like that. Any kind of classified ads went up in smoke. People aren't meeting, and that's sort of the core of a lot of alternative press. But they were just a leading edge, the canary in the coal mine. And you started to see daily newspapers that were once robust say, we're not going to print as many times a week. The Tampa Bay Times, which has not been that robust of late, but nonetheless, it's the largest and in some ways proudest newspaper in Florida, along with perhaps the Miami Herald. Tampa Bay Times said, we're going to publish 2 days a week now for the near future. We don't know how long that'll last. They've started to furlough people. That is, make people take forced time off. USA Today is owned by the Gannett Corporation, which owns over 200 newspapers across the country. They said everybody is going to have to take Gannett said everybody's going to have to take 4 days, a full week off every month unpaid. So that's like a 23% pay cut. You know, this is happening at newspaper across the country, whether furloughs, pay cuts, some job cuts, people shuttering print editions, at least temporarily, in some cases permanently.
Wow. Now, so is this the culmination of this perfect storm that we've been seeing over the past several years? You mentioned Facebook, chief amongst them, sucking away the ad revenue, and also, quite frankly, capitalizing on the content that these news organizations were providing without paying them for it. And then we have the consolidation of ownership, as you mentioned, with some of these big companies scooping up a lot of local media outlets. And now this immediately drying of the well of the rest of or whatever was left in terms of local advertising. I mean, David, when you put it all together like that, it sounds like the final nail in the coffin for local news in so many places across this country.
It's hard to know. I think a lot of people are fighting to survive, to fight another day. And so you're seeing a lot of pretty severe cuts, and you're seeing newsroom leaders at times and union members at times say, well, this isn't being done in a fair or appropriate way. The Tribune Publishing Company, which owns the Chicago Tribune, my own old paper in Baltimore, the New York Daily News, Hartford Current, a couple big papers in Florida and some others, they're saying we're going to do some pay cuts. But unlike other places, they're saying, and we're going to make those pay cuts permanent for people over making more than $67,000 a year. Now, the Tribune Publishing is owned by and has been controlled by executives who over the last, call it 4 years, have really extracted an extraordinary amount of millions of dollars into their own pockets in benefits and pay. So it's hard to fully reconcile the idea of permanent pay cuts for a newsroom that is going out at times in person to cover the pandemic, some of whom have contracted a coronavirus themselves. Of course, they can't be 100% sure exactly where or how, but nonetheless, asking them to do more, to provide more of a service, hours, you know, blur between daytime and nighttime, weekday and weekend. These people are working hard, and at the same time, they're being asked to, in many cases, accept permanent pay cuts that will extend beyond this current fiscal crisis. I think that's a bitter pill to swallow. And you've seen analogous circumstances in other places. Gannett is owned by a Fortress and controlled, I should say, it's publicly traded, controlled by Fortress Investment Group, which is really owned by the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank. And it has been whisking away, I believe, not just the eight figures, but nine figures, like more than $100 million a year in fees, legal, financial, corporate, and others, levied against the revenues that Gannett brings in. Well, that's a lot of money to siphon off and then say to folks, you're going to have to take a week off every month, even as you're being asked to produce so much content about this peril to the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, if I can, I want to reach back to an interview you did in February with John Thornton, the founder of the American Journalism Project. It's actually a venture philanthropy that's trying to preserve local news. And you talked to him about how he raises money and what it's spent on.
The idea is to do two things. One is to bring that news, begin to bring that news gathering spend back into the ecosystem. And the other is to multiply the number of examples that we feel like we can say are, and you've got to use air quotes, but air quotes, sustainable, so that we have models to point to going forward in multiplying yet again the number of those that that are serving their community.
So these can be diverse models in terms of how they work, but all under the rubric of mission-driven and all under the rubric of not-for-profit.
You got it.
So, David, that was a conversation that you had with John Thornton back in February. Tell us more about the work that they're doing there and what it might bode for the future of local journalism.
Well, I think that, you know, Thornton helped to create the American Journalism Project, and he's looking to provide seed money ultimately in all 50 states to news outlets, as he said, to find different ways to perhaps distinct for those communities, organic to those areas that may be financially viable for those areas, to prop up news organizations, news reporting. The idea being, you know, it may be that it goes to conventional news outlets that are trying to innovate and reshape themselves, or it may be to completely new startups. But the idea being that the important thing is that Americans have the information they need to make informed choices about their communities and understand what's going on. Less than that, whatever institution that exists currently is what we must prop up. So it's an ambitious effort. They haven't been able, I think, to distribute as much money as they had hoped by now, because I think it's hard. And right now, it's an urgent time, but they're trying to distribute money as well. He did it with Elizabeth Green, was his co-founder, and I believe they've just named a new CEO there as well. And I think, you know, John has an extraordinary track record in terms of what they accomplished with the Texas Tribune, which is a politics and policy digital site, often data-driven, reporting-driven, totally non-ideological as far as I can make out, to provide people a sense of what's happening in Texas, where money comes to play, what the effects are. They've done a lot of good coverage on campaign finance, on immigration, on agrarian policy and the like there. And I think he's hoping to bring that same kind of spirit nationally. You've also seen Report for America, which is a venture done by Charles Sennett and others. Sennett created Ground Truth, which was this effort to help subsidize reporters abroad and do so at home now as well, with stipends and enough money to sustain so that they could do freelance reporting for other outlets and get them placed. In this case, Report for America is helping to pay for reporters in outlets across the country, particularly in beats that are underserved but vitally important right now. And I think that you're going to have to see a lot of folks coming together. You know, in some ways, you know, this is a little bit like the ragtag regatta that showed up at Dunkirk to get people out, right, and get them back to Britain. This is going to be an effort that's going to take a lot of actors. And, you know, there are even questions now of whether the federal government or state governments should be involved in subsidizing the news that has implications. We haven't always seen that people act in enlightened ways when people in political and governmental power have levers to exercise over news organizations. But I think you can rightly argue that public radio and public broadcasting and television has shown that we can provide accountability journalism, even with funneling some governmental money through various kind of subsidiary corporations that get back to these outlets. I think you're going to have to see a lot of different experimentation, because right now the old model is breaking to the point of broken.
Breaking to the point of broken. And that just takes me back to then the long-term impact on democracy, and especially at the local level, where arguably the policymakers and politicians and business leaders at the local level have a more intense, profound, and immediate impact on life in their community than someone in a White House thousands of miles away. I mean, that's the thing that I keep coming back to, is that there's an immediacy to the loss of local news in communities that perhaps we don't feel when some big national outlets have to tighten their belts.
And let's also notice that if you're thinking about particularly the three biggest news organizations, New York Times, the newspapers, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, they've successfully convinced people to pay for them digitally as indispensable. That's made up a huge amount of the revenue. You haven't seen that below those big three when it comes to mainstream newspapers, and that's where the problem is.
So when we come back, maybe we should talk about that, about if it's time for a lot more innovative thinking along the lines of what John Thornton is doing at the local level. So David, hang in there with me. We'll be right back. We are talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact it's having on local news outlets and therefore on local democracy. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host David Folkenflik joins us today to talk about the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic is having on local news across this country. Because, of course, in addition to being On Point co-host, David is NPR's media correspondent. And over the past day, we heard from many local journalists around the country. Here's Aaron, a local newspaper reporter in Bowling Green, Kentucky. He left us a voicemail about what his paper is offering.
Local papers are offering vital coverage right now. My paper has been offering daily updates of COVID-19 cases and deaths in our area. And we've lifted our paywall for all our coverage of the pandemic. Many local newspapers are taking a financial hit right now. So if you can, please subscribe to your local newspaper.
That's Aaron in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And here's Wendy Thomas in Memphis, Tennessee. She's editor at MLK50 Justice Through Journalism, a nonprofit reporting project on economic justice in Memphis. And she called to tell us about collaboration among news outlets in her area.
If there's been a bright spot during this time, it's the collaborations that have emerged with several Memphis newsrooms, including ours. So in the span of a week, we published an investigation on local hospitals' capacity to handle a surge of COVID-19 patients. And that was by MLK50, the Memphis Business Journal, and the Commercial Appeal, the daily paper here in Memphis. And in collaboration with another newsroom here, High Ground News, MLK50 is publishing a series of first-person essays by workers whose income has been decimated during the pandemic. I'm very proud of the way these newsrooms have come together during this time of crisis, and we're confident that this is something that will continue even after the pandemic has passed.
That's Wendy Thomas, the editor at MLK50 Justice Through Journalism. Well, joining us now is Josh Stearns. He's director of the Public Square Program at the Democracy Fund. Josh, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so give us your take on what you've been hearing so far. Are you concerned about the long-term impact of this pandemic and the economic hit that local journalism is taking?
I am. I'm deeply concerned for all of the reasons that you've been discussing over the past hour, but I am also really hopeful for the models like Wendy Thomas in Tennessee there, who we just heard from, the way that newsrooms are pulling together and dropping their competitive spirit and embracing a collaborative spirit that's dedicated to serving the community in this moment.
You're feeling optimistic that perhaps new models, new viable models could emerge out of this?
I think new models have to emerge out of this. I think, as Bree said earlier in the hour, the model has to change. And I think it probably won't be just one model. I think it'll be many models that are really rooted in the opportunities and challenges of local communities.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. Maybe I'll just be our in-house cynic here, because I'm not sure I'm feeling that same optimism. And here's why, Josh. Because perhaps if this had been a shock that we were only recently feeling, I might say, all right, well, there's still a strong core to local newsrooms around the country that would allow them to not only weather this catastrophe, but innovate out of it. But as David was pointing out earlier, we're already at a point where, I don't know, what is it, like 50% of the country is essentially in a local news desert.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we saw some pretty troubling statistics recently out of a Brookings report that found that just in the places where COVID-19 cases were happening, 50% were news deserts, and 37% saw local newspapers disappear from 2004 to 2019. So you're right that this isn't a new crisis. This is one that has been mounting for a while. But I also believe that we might see a new kind of response from this moment because of the way that journalism is playing into the public debate about how important news and information is in this moment.
Okay. I'm gonna ask you for some of those ideas and what you're seeing out there, some more details in just a second. But there's one more thing I want to just bring up here. And I'm not the first to raise this. I've seen people in the journalism world ask this question. I mean, we're talking about local journalism as a core public good right now in the middle of a crisis. And in fact, I think it's fair to say that people who may have only a casual relationship with their local newspaper, even their local public radio station, in the midst of a crisis that hits home, they absolutely turn to their local journalists in that moment. And at the same time, we've been seeing a lot of these news outlets that might have had paywalls take them down around their COVID-19 coverage. So here's the question. And again, I'm not the first to wonder this, but we don't ask groceries to give away food, right? We're not asking first responders to work without pay in most circumstances. So if indeed local journalism, Josh, is a public good, are they doing the wrong thing? Or a public good that comes at a cost, are they doing the wrong thing by taking down those paywalls?
I think that the paywalls were created in a moment to respond to the ongoing challenges that have been in existence. And those paywalls, for some, have been really successful. But in a moment of crisis like this, I really respect the choices of people who are pulling down their paywalls for this COVID coverage. And I think it's a reminder that not only is journalism a public good, but it's a public good going through a market failure.
Yeah.
And when we go through market failures, there's a set of responses that we have to consider, from philanthropy to public funding and others.
Right. So this is I'm so glad you phrased it that way, Josh, because, I mean, one must ask, should public goods ever be allowed to be subject to market failures, right? If they are, by definition, an essential good for the entire public.
That's right. And I think that for a long time, we understood a kind of social contract between our communities and our newsrooms. It was a social contract that I think inspired the founders to put the press into our First Amendment. And you describe the impact that we're facing right now as a democracy black hole. And I just want to sort of share a little bit about what that black hole might look like, because the academic research on this is really clear that when communities lose local news, fewer people vote, fewer people run for office, government corruption and waste expand, and our neighborhoods grow more polarized. Local news can actually help us bridge polarization and connect us. And so local news doesn't just bring us information, but it actually brings us together.
So then Give us some examples if you think that you think are worthy innovations to look at or attempts going on right now that might help local news outlets find their way through this darkness.
Well, I've spent the last decade working with newsrooms to try to figure out new ways to pay for journalism, new business models, new revenue strategies, new structures and services that they can provide. And one of the challenges of this moment is even some of those new ways of paying for journalism, which include events and sponsorships and underwriting, things that have been existing in public radio for a long time but are new to other parts of journalism, even those are being hit because obviously you can't do a big event if you are all socially isolating. But the organizations who I'm seeing who have invested deeply in building community connections and relationships, those are the ones that are weathering the storm initially better and are better positioned to continue to build the kinds of services and new structures that communities are looking for as the news begins to change.
Okay, so that's interesting. David, the idea of also not just providing community connections, but Josh said services as well. I mean, there's an argument to be made that part of the problem is that perhaps local news in the good times stopped or was providing fewer of the kind of services that people were looking for.
I think we've got to acknowledge the unspoken thing is that people's content behavior changed. They went online when they could.
That's right.
It was immediate. It was updated instantaneously. They could get it from beyond their geographic borders. So, you know, I could read content about the California Angels without having to have my mom clip out articles from the LA Times anymore. And then I was looking at the LA Times website. I wasn't sending them money. By the way, I am now. I think that that's a small example of the ways in which this was consumer driven. They could go to cars.com. They didn't have to look at the car classifieds or the auto section on Saturdays in a lot of newspapers. So that hit as well. But, you know, I think that newspapers think hardest about the services they provide when times are toughest. As a young reporter, I went and covered Hurricane Andrew's aftermath in southern Florida, which has brutalized that part of the peninsula down there. And the Miami Herald ran page after page after page of people trying to connect with relatives. After all, it was pre-cell phones, pre-internet. Mm-hmm. Page after page of people who had lost pets. Page after page of people, you know, seeking housing. And they just provided them free for people. And these things became bulletin boards, much in the way that after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, the Times-Picayune was a rallying cry for that community. I talked to people down there. They would gather in places that still had enough energy to run lights on, and they'd sit and they'd have shared readings of the newspaper. There are times at which newspapers are able and news outlets are able to rekindle and reforge that relationship with their communities. And I would argue that news organizations and news executives should be thinking right now about how they can be doing that, both in service to their communities and with an eye towards the future.
Yeah. Well, Josh, we've just got a short period of time left here, but there's one more sort of area of potential innovation, at least in the U.S. context, I wanted to ask you about. Because David did mention earlier that, for example, public television and public radio provides a model, whether you like the model or not, of some federal funding being part of the picture here. Now, that's a bit of a sticky question, actually, and I was wondering what you thought about that for federal funding writ larger across local journalism.
I think there's a huge and important conversation to be had about public funding and financing for local journalism. And I think that if we look across the world, we see a variety of different models. So here in the US, right now, for the public broadcasting that exists in 50 states, we only spend $1.34 per person in our taxes on public broadcasting. We could be doing a lot more, and we could be having a really huge impact on the access to important community information, both in times of emergency, but also long after. And I think that we don't have to give up independence. You hinted at earlier that public radio and TV are still able to do important critical accountability reporting. And there was a study done by an NYU professor named Rod Benson who looked at 14 other democratic nations with robust public financing of journalism and found case after case after case that the public-funded broadcasters were more aggressive of their governments than the commercial press was.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's really compelling data there. But at the same time, I also want to acknowledge that there's a pretty profound debate about this issue, and we'll have it. We'll come back to it another day, but we've just flat out run out of time here today. So Josh Stearns, director of the Public Square Program at the Democracy Fund, a bipartisan group that excuse me, I'm going to get this right, a bipartisan foundation established by eBay's founder to ensure the American people come first in a democracy. That's what the Democracy Fund calls itself. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
And David Folkenflik, On Point's co-host and NPR media correspondent. David, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Great to hear your voice again.
All right. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about how small businesses are faring in the U.S. This is On Point. Well, like many thousands of small businesses across the country, the Brattle Bookshop in downtown Boston has had to temporarily close its doors due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is only the second time the Brattle Bookshop has had to close its doors for this long since opening for business first in 1825. Now, the only other time they had to close their doors is because of a fire. Now, you won't be able to walk in right now and get a book, but Ken Gloss, antique book dealer and proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop, says you can take advantage of one of their other services.
Now, we've always done decorating for movies, for plays, for open houses, advertising. So we're used to that. And when you look into their house in a Zoom background, it tells a lot about their personality, who they are. It offers a lot of prestige, intellect.
Zoom background. Okay, now millions of people are practically living on Zoom right now, or at least it feels that way. So Gloss is offering to bring the Brattle Bookshop's antiquarian touch to your endless video conferencing life, specifically to those Zoom backgrounds. And Gloss says that all he needs to know are the dimensions of the shelves and what kind of bookish image you're trying to project. And they created this new service in the hopes of staying connected to their customers, keeping their business alive, and to have some fun.
The way this whole idea started, I would like to say it was me, but it was actually two of the managers here. They were watching Zoom, and they were looking at everybody's background. And when you work in the used and rare book business, you tend to look at the books in the background. And they were saying, gee, a lot of people, they don't have the greatest books back there. You want a background that shows something, either part of your personality, prestige. So they were joking back and forth on Twitter, and then a couple of people got in touch with us and said, can you do that? And thought we could curate what they wanted. In a time like this of sort of isolating and distancing, this is a way of connecting with customers and seeing and talking with them and showing pictures, and you sort of get personal. And any type of contact like that nowadays and really getting to know somebody is a huge, huge help. And it also gives us something fun to do. What I would have in my background is a lot of Boston history, and maybe there'd be a Stephen King or a John Grisham, and definitely I would have some Doris Goodwin and books on books so that people realized I deal with books. Our business, we're absolutely no question that we're going to survive this, that we're going to get through it. There's an experience that goes back 40 years ago, our building burnt down, the store, literally to the ground. We rebuilt, we got open, and now the business plan is there's going to be a disaster every year. Plan for it. Have some backup and plans. And we weren't expecting anything like this. But somehow I have no doubt that we'll deal with it. It's fun. It's a great diversion. And we're getting a lot of people who would not normally ever have thought of coming to a used secondhand rare bookstore in downtown Boston. And we're hoping that a lot of them, even when they can get out of the house, that they'll become good customers and maybe some good friends, too.
Ken Gloss, antique book dealer and proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston. Now, that's just one example of the lengths that small businesses are going to right now to stay afloat. And tomorrow, we're going to talk about how the federal Paycheck Protection Program ran out of money almost instantly and what that means for American small businesses. The millions of small business owners and employees in this country, they're a cornerstone of the U.S. economy. So we want to hear from you if you're a small business owner or employee. What has happened to you in your business? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. This is On Point.